It's the Burt Cohen Show. Seen a lot of streets of gold for a certain segment of our society here in America in the last few years. We've heard about Occupy Wall Street and about the 99% versus the 1%. And a lot of people have been asking, what's going on here? Can we create an economy for the 100%? Can it be done? The playing field has not been level for quite some time. And I'm very pleased to have with us on the Burt Cohen Show today, Chuck Collins. Chuck, thanks for being here.
Hey, great to be with you, Burt.
All right. Well, his new book he's written quite a few, is called 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It, which is always rather hopeful. Chuck Collins, if you don't know, is one of the world's top writers, speakers, researchers, and activists on the rise of inequality in our society and its harmful effects. In this new book, 99 to 1, he brings together ideas that have developed through articles, reports, websites, and street activism. Never underestimate street activism to articulate the thoughts and dreams of a rising movement. Chuck Collins is senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and directs their program on inequality and the common good. He's co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good. And I very much enjoyed part of the foreword to this book, Barbara Ehrenreich. She said, as an activist who has worked with both ends of the economic spectrum, low-income people struggling to get by, and millionaires concerned about the future of our country, Chuck Collins is one of our premier experts, on inequality. Why did you decide to write this book, and what is your relationship to the 99% and to the 1%?
Well, I think it was, Bert, the events of the fall and the emergence of the We Are the 99% movement that I think has really changed the whole conversation about inequality. It certainly brought it much more to the fore. And it was in very late October, around Halloween, that Barrett Kohler Publishing asked me to, you know, can you quickly write a book on this whole issue of inequality, and that's very solution oriented. And I was happy to do that. And when we picked the title, some people objected, "Oh, the 99 to 1, isn't that a little simplistic, et cetera." But you know, I like to tell people, you know, I grew up in the 1%. I'm from a large family business that was very successful. Actually, grew up in the Detroit suburbs and went to the same high school with Mitt Romney.
Oh, no kidding.
And he, so we both came out of that same, you know, sort of affluent suburban context. His dad was the governor at the time of Michigan. So it's, I don't come at this from a, I hate the 1% kind of axe grind. Actually know the 1%. I know that there are a lot of people in the 1% who have, you know, devoted their whole lives to organizing a fair economy. So I think that's part of my message, is to just help us sort of break down and understand, when we talk about 99 to 1, who are we talking about, and what are the different players there?
And there are a lot of different players, and you go into that quite a bit, you know, because it's not people think about the way a lot of the Republicans are trying to cast this as a class war between the 99% and the 1%, as if, you know, the 99% were feeling like they're all good and the 1% are all bad. It's not that way at all. I wonder if you can describe some of the different players within the 1%, as you describe in the book. There's people who have really gamed the system, but that's not everybody. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, I've been fortunate to be part of some organizing efforts like the Patriotic Millionaires, Wealth for the Common Good. These are people in the 1% working for an economy that works for the 100%. So they're out there, they're active, they're engaged, often behind the scenes trying to make things happen in a good way. But I also say, hey, look, we all need to understand that within the 1%, there's a segment that I characterize as the rule riggers, the game fixers. They use their wealth and power to influence the democratic system, to influence Congress and the rule writers, and to tip the rules in their favor. So they use their wealth and power to funnel more wealth and power to the top. And those are the folks we should be very, very concerned about and protect ourselves from in many respects.
Well, you talked about your buddy Mitt Romney. I'm not sure, of course, which Mitt Romney you knew, because you must know that old joke now, you know, a liberal, a conservative, a moderate walk into a bar and the bartender says, "Hi, Mitt." We'll let that one go anyway. But the Republican Party these days does seem to be very, very different from the Republican Party that you and I grew up in. We're about, I guess, the same age. You know, the Republican Party used to be pro-small business and just not for too much government. But now it seems to me that they're saying that extreme wealth in and of itself is virtuous, which is an old-fashioned word, virtue, that some of the founders of this country talked about. So the current Republican Party says that extreme wealth in and of itself is virtuous and is a benefit to society. But you start out with this declaration: extreme inequalities of wealth are undermining much of what we hold dear. I wonder if you could explain that statement. How are extreme inequalities of wealth undermining so much of what we hold dear? I don't think a lot of people get that yet.
Yeah. What the research is showing, and a lot of it's emerging in the last 10 years, is that poverty, obviously, matters a lot in terms of, you know, health and well-being, but the gap between extreme wealth and extreme poverty is actually at the root of a whole bunch of social breakdowns and problems. I'm getting a little abstract here, but think about what is it you care about? You care about your health, you care about children, grandchildren, there are opportunities. We care about social mobility, the ability of people not to feel stuck in one rung of the class ladder, but have the opportunities to move up if they choose and work hard. The functioning of our democracy, the stability of our economy. In each of those areas, growing research shows that the extreme concentrations of wealth and inequality are trashing, undermining are all these things that matter. You're better off living in a less unequal society in terms of your public health. Even if you're rich, you're better off living in a society with greater equality than being extremely wealthy in an unequal society. Your public health and your individual health will be better. Your well-being and happiness will be better. Social mobility. We used to think that the United States was the most socially mobile country, advanced industrial country, the American dream. If you work hard, you can rise. Well, we used to look over at Europe and Canada and say, oh, those are the old caste societies. If you're born into the English working class, you die in the English working class. Well, guess what, Bert? That's totally flipped now. The United States is the least mobile of the industrialized countries, and European countries are much more mobile. Why is that? Because they invest in education systems, early childhood education. They're doing all the things that we should be doing or used to do, but no longer are involved in doing. And so in each of these areas, democracy, obviously, the fact that you know, the 1% has so much wealth and power,
yes,
undermines the health of our democracy. So on and on and down the list, in every area, there's all this. You could almost have a department of a university that just looks at inequality studies and how in a cross-disciplinary way, how they affect everything we care about.
You know, I think it's fascinating by that it seems to me, at least so far, I'm sensing some change starting to happen. But most people who have been in the middle class, I mean, the middle class has been largely decimated in the past few years, I think starting with Ronald Reagan, but we'll talk about that. They still feel like, well, you know, they identify with the rich. They don't want the rich to be taxed anymore. And we're talking about really the super rich and the, as we say, that, you know, if you look at all the charts, and the book is very good for graphics and charts showing what has gone on. But people, most people don't seem to care at all about the concentration of wealth at all. I get a big, so what, you know, that most people don't really care about inequality, you know, that, well, some people have made a lot of money. Don't the rich deserve to enjoy their wealth? Most people seem to feel that. But you're suggesting that it's not like it used to be, where we always had social mobility, and that's one of the great things we always loved growing up in the 50s and 60s, and that it's not changing. But what about that idea? I mean, if the rich have a lot of money, you know, why not let them be as rich as they possibly can?
Yeah, I think that you're right, Bert, that has been historically, at least, you know, in our lifetime, kind of a majority attitude.
Right.
We have a pretty high tolerance for inequality if we believe that the rules are fair and that there is mobility and everybody has an opportunity. Then we can sit back and say, well, you know, inequality is a reflection of deservedness. People who have a lot of wealth and income have worked harder and therefore are entitled to it, and people who don't have made other choices or made bad decisions, and they, but there's sort of two really important points here. One, public opinion is now showing that attitude has shifted, and I think in part because of the 2008 economic meltdown, a lot more people are realizing, A, that the rules of the economy have been rigged to benefit the 1%, and that actually undermines opportunity for everyone else. And two, that we now see this decline in mobility, which is a fact. So more people are saying they care about inequality because of that. The other thing is we should stop talking about these extreme inequalities at all in this kind of individual story of success, story of bad decision framework. The concentrations of wealth that we're living through now have nothing to do with differences in individual effort or intelligence or deservedness. These are distortions. They are, in a sense, the result of monopoly power and the power of the wealthy to warp and distort the rules of the system. You know, how else can you explain why domestic small businesses pay a much higher effective tax rate than global corporations that use the tax code and use the offshore system to gain their taxes down to nothing? There's no economic justification for that. There's certainly no moral justification for it. It's simply they have the power to rig the rules in their favor. That has nothing to do with deservedness. So there's some myths that are popping and cracking as we talk.
Well, they certainly are, and I'm sensing a change is starting to happen. Chuck Collins, you brought up a number of issues that I'd like to follow up on. Most of us know about Warren Buffett. He's one of the wealthiest people in the world, I believe. He's exceedingly wealthy, and he talks quite publicly about that he's paying a lower tax rate than the people who work for him, notably his secretary. But I want to ask, isn't the purpose of lower tax rates to spur investments that create jobs? The lower tax rates for the big capitalist, isn't the idea, well, if they lower tax rates, they'll invest more and create more jobs. So what's wrong with that?
Well, it's another very, very powerful myth. And actually, we have a whole network of business leaders through Business for Shared Prosperity and Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires. These are business people who will say, look, taxes is a very minor consideration if you're contemplating investing or expanding hiring in your company. You know, what small business people, what entrepreneurs and business people need is customers. They need a healthy middle class that has money in their pocket, or they need, you know, people with disposable income.
Right.
And so that's it's somewhat of a canard. And what's great is there's now, you know, this whole segment of business people who are saying, you know what, it's really not in our interests to allow these extreme inequalities to grow. They're bad for business. They're bad for healthy capitalism. They're bad for entrepreneurs who are trying to start out with a good idea. We've tipped the rules and we've tipped the playing field in favor of those who already have, and that's not very good for everyone else. So I think that that's another one of the, you know, or the other thing is, you know, people will say, well, these are the job creators.
Right.
And we need to give more tax breaks to XYZ company because they're the job creators.
Right.
Well, we should be very clear. There's a segment of companies in this society, they are not built to last long-term, you know, trying to add value to the community and build wealth over time. They have a very short-term outlook. I call them built-to-loot companies.
Yes.
They are trying to take the money and run and pay their CEOs as much as possible in this year, and they're not really concerned about long-term shareholder value or community health. And they are bad actors. And when they say that they're job creators, that's a bunch of hooey. They're job destroyers. Their whole business model is about shedding and offshoring jobs. It has nothing to do with job creation, and we should be calling them on that.
Absolutely. I find it almost humorous, if it weren't so disturbing, when you hear various right-wing politicians saying they just replace the word exceptionally wealthy with job creators. You know, he's not a rich person, he's a job creator. And isn't it, in your analysis, and you've obviously done a heck of a lot of analysis, the economic meltdown of 2008 that could have pushed this country over the brink, it was really close there. There was a lot of funny money going on there. And I can't help but think that some of this rule rigging to work for, to make the system, you know, to rig the games, to make it work for just the extremely powerful wealthy, was really part of the problem. And if I could, I had Kevin Phillips on the show a long time ago. He wrote a very interesting book, Bad Money, Reckless Finance, Failed Politics, and the Global Crisis of American Capitalism. In that, he pointed out that the financial sector, as opposed to manufacturing, has taken over the economy. The financial sector, they just move money around, and they created this hedge funds and did that bundling of subprime mortgages. They didn't produce any goods or services. Do you see any, well, how much of a problem, Chuck, is the financial sector and the power that they have? And the second part of that is, do you see any movement in Washington to rein in the financial sector?
Good question. I would echo what you said, that the expansion of the financial sector, you know, at the eve of the economic meltdown, the financial, you know, banking and investment sector was taking 40% of all the profits of the whole economy.
Wow.
And the share just kept growing. And you have these six big mega banks, you know, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, you know, that their share of the banking sector has expanded dramatically since 2008. They've been growing and swallowing up other actors. And underlying that is a certain amount of corruption and political favoritism. And the, you know, Bank of America has been, you know, very active in using its political power to fend off oversight and regulation, to roll back and weaken the Dodd-Frank financial reform law, which was already weak in terms of financial oversight. They're setting us up for another bubble. You know, they're setting us up for more bad bank failures. And we have to be ready to say, look, these banks are not only too big to fail, they're they're getting too big to save. They're too big. They're just too big. They should be broken up into smaller pieces. And the next time one of them wobbles and comes begging to the government for more government handouts, we should say, sorry, you're too big to fail. We're gonna break you into smaller pieces, you know, in exchange for saving at least some of the stakeholders. And, you know, be ready to make that case. So the bad news is there's nothing in the short term, as you ask, in Washington, D.C., that's going to actually address this, because the federal political system, Congress, has been completely captured by global corporations and the banking sector. I mean, Senator Dick Durbin said the banks own this place when he was talking about the powerful bank and finance lobby. So nothing's going to happen in the short term. Nothing's going to happen on most of the agenda that is urgent for the 99%. That's the unfortunate thing.
Well, let's go back.
But I also think the pressure is building for realignment.
Yeah, and it's often the case. I wish I had the direct quote, but FDR completely understood when he was meeting with A. Philip Randolph, who was the head of the Pullman Porters Union, the railroad workers, for equality, and he met with President Roosevelt, and Roosevelt said, yeah, I agree with you. I want this to happen. Now make me do it. And that's what has to happen. It has to come from the streets. It just absolutely has to. And, you know, because if the politicians don't feel that pressure, what are they going to feel? They're going to feel the power from the game riggers.
Yeah.
Not just the
one. You know, the good news is, you know, people aren't waiting. They're not waiting for President Obama to lead on this.
Right.
You know, he's made some very powerful statements about economic inequality in the last couple months. But my interpretation of that is he's trying to get out in front of the parade. He's mirroring public opinion, and he's not really leading. He's responding, and that's fine because, you know, we have to go out and make our elected officials do the right thing. If there's no pressure from the base, then they're not. You know.
See, that's one of the things is that, you know, people can complain and feel frustrated. Like, so many people feel powerless. And the game riggers, whatever you want to call them, the people who have changed the rules to benefit the extreme wealth and power, they want us to believe we're powerless. They're very, it serves their interest for we the people, for the 99%, and for the good people in the 1%, to accept a sense of powerlessness, just to give up, that we can't do anything about it. But there is precedent in American history going back. Now, it takes a little bit of patience, and certainly with this 21st century, all the iPhones, iPads, I this, I that, people have very short, you know, they're not as focused and patient on things. We want immediate change, and it doesn't ever happen like that. But according to your understanding of the American economy and since we've been around, it seems to me the last time in our history when people seem to care about concentrated wealth was the turn of the last century, when there was a populist confrontation of what was then called the Gilded Age, rather similar to now. How did they make the changes? I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that era, and do you think people have that patience and perseverance now?
Well, it's a really important historical fact that you're raising here, which is 100 years ago was the last time we had this period of extreme inequality. It really went probably from the 1880s right up into the Great Depression, 1929. It was a period when the 1% had an estimated 45% of all the wealth, according to Kevin Phillips and others who you mentioned earlier. And, you know, and yet, by 1955, we had an economy that was working quite differently, that we were seeing an expansion of the middle class, a reduction in inequality, a kind of flowering of wealth and opportunity for more and more citizens.
Yeah, it was great.
So what happened between, you know, the first Gilded Age and the post-World War II period of prosperity? How did we get there? And there's no single answer to that. I mean, there were two world wars and a depression. But at the core of that, there were social movements that pressed to make these issues of inequality at the center of our national debate. A lot of people worried that if you had concentrated wealth in the hands of a few, we would have a corruption of our fragile democratic republic experiment.
Which we've had.
And even, you know, Theodore Roosevelt and Louis Brandeis, he was not yet a Supreme Court justice, but he said, you know, you can have concentrated wealth in the hands of a few, or you can have democracy. But what happened was you had rural populists, you had the emerging urban workers and worker movements, you had women getting the vote, you had pressure for progressive tax policies. So in 1916, we had the first inheritance tax at the federal level, the first high income tax, and over the period of the Depression, Franklin Roosevelt raised those taxes and also implemented New Deal policies like Social Security that eliminated elder poverty and sort of put a floor under, you know, how fall, you know, basic minimum income for many people. So the simple answer is we implemented public policies that raised the floor and expanded opportunity. You know, 15 million people went to got a debt-free college education after World War II, thanks to the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
35 million people got first-time homebuyer loans. You know, 1% 40-year mortgages, government-subsidized mortgages.
Wow.
That was what primed the pump of the middle-class expansion. But we also taxed the wealthy at very progressive levels and invested those funds in things that created opportunity. So that was the formula for reversing a generation of inequality.
And it's fascinating to me how stark it is now that the new Republican Party wants to roll back every single one of those things that you just mentioned, Chuck, that created the socially mobile society, that helped us enable people to reach prosperity. And they want to roll every single one of those back and restore us to yet another golden age. They don't even pretend. I think they would suggest that, well, perhaps it might even be un-American, anti-American, to push for less concentrated income and wealth. Is it, I mean, if you look at, you know, the ideal Marxist totalitarian state, which has never been, but that no one has more wealth than anyone else. It takes away incentives, and that's one reason it's failed. But I wonder if you could talk to this. Is it not anti-American to say there really should be a cap on income and wealth? There should be high taxes, higher rates of taxes for the wealthy, and a floor for everybody? I mean, are you talking Marxism here?
Well, you know, these were the policies under the socialist presidency of Dwight Eisenhower.
Right.
I mean, there was essentially a business class that understood that too much inequality would undercut a healthy business environment. The expansion of the middle class was one of the best things for the U.S. economy. Incidentally, in Brazil and in India, the most dynamic countries in the world, are seeing huge expansions of their middle class, which are leading to unparalleled levels of economic growth, very similar to what the United States experienced in the 1950s and 1960s.
Why is it happening?
Because
there?
Of this flowering of middle class opportunity. Shared prosperity, widely shared prosperity, is good for an economy. Too much concentrated wealth. You know, think about the economic meltdown, Bert. We had a generation of middle class and working class consumption, not based on real wages going up, but based on people's ability to borrow.
Yes.
Borrow on their credit card, borrow if they owned a home, borrow on their home. And that's how we got into trouble. That wasn't real prosperity. That was debt-based, flimsy prosperity. And when the economy ground to a halt in 2008, we essentially sort of took the mask off of these inequalities. We said, hey, wow, how did working class and middle class people survive the last 20 years? They've worked more hours per household, taken on multiple jobs, and borrowed to maintain a standard of living. And that's what got us into trouble. So, you know, I like to talk to business people because, you know, and we work with lots of business people who basically get this. This is bad for capitalism. This is bad for the healthy functioning of the market. This is bad for economic growth. So if those are the things that move you, you should be really alarmed about these distorting the corrosive effect of concentrated wealth and power. And you know, it's interesting when you have Newt Gingrich attacking Mitt Romney for being a vulture capitalist.
Right.
You can even see that within the conservative tradition, there's a break there.
Well, you talk about, I mean, there's conservatives, and then there's these plutocratic right-wingers that are anything but conservative, as far as I can tell. And Chuck, you have talked about this spiral here, the inequality death spiral. I had never heard that phrase before described as, you know, what's happening now with this a few people with tremendous wealth and a lot of people with a heck of a lot less wealth and social mobility than they used to be. If we continue on this, well, I wonder if you could describe the spiral and what happens if we don't intervene in this dynamic.
Yeah, it's a bit dramatic imagery, but basically the argument is the more wealth concentrates in the hands of a few, the more that that little segment of game riggers and rule fixers will use their wealth and power to change the rules of the economy to funnel more wealth and power to themselves, which in turn undermines the quality of life for the vast majority of people in this country. So it becomes kind of a vicious cycle. And the only way to really reverse that is to intervene and say, you know, essentially we need to, break up the concentrations of wealth and power. You know, we've been living through a redistribution of wealth. Everybody always gets all nervous when they hear those words, redistribution of wealth.
But well, we've seen it.
We've been living through it.
Absolutely.
You know, there's been an upward redistribution of wealth. We've, you know, destroyed the middle class standard of living to funnel more wealth to the 1%. And if people think it's all about bad government, that's not it. The government, the rules of the government have been hijacked and captured and tilted to benefit the 1%, but that's not because government's bad. It's because it's been captured. And so we're redistributing wealth to the top. And think about your bill. You know, pull out your credit card bill or your phone bill, and you'll see each of us are nickel and dimed every day with fees and interest rates. We're all paying huge amounts of interest for various things. Well, where does that money go? Who owns that debt? The way in which, and then we're also paying, oh, well, now we have to go to the state park that used to be free, but now we pay $5.
Right.
Or we're paying the higher cost of the privatization of certain services. You know, that's the squeeze that's on us that's funneling wealth to the top. We keep paying our taxes, and the super rich pay less and less taxes. Small businesses in this country pay a much higher effective tax rate than international businesses that game the system. So this is about creating a level playing field in many cases.
And I wonder if more small businesses are getting it. There's a local pizza shop here, great guy that runs it. Oh, I'll say the name, Ken's West End Pizza. He goes in there and he realizes we need demand side. You know, where's the demand for small businesses? They, unless there's demand to buy stuff, they're not going to survive. You know, the supply side stuff just didn't work at all, and I think that's part of how we got here. And, well, actually thinking of supply side, good old Ronald Reagan. A lot of people point to the beginning of Ronald Reagan's term as to when this concentration and fixing the game really started to happen. How much of is he to blame for all this?
Well, that was sort of a turning point, although really began in the late 1970s, that growing tilting toward the beginning of tilting the rules toward benefiting the 1%.
Mm-hmm.
But a whole lot of things happened in the late 1970s and early 80s. One of the things that was interesting is that prior to that, if you cut taxes, government spending would go down. If you raise taxes, you could expand government opportunity. What happened in the 80s with Ronald Reagan is they cut taxes and then, you know, instituted one of the biggest military buildups in history.
Yes.
So under conservative and democratic government, we saw growing debts and rising inequality. And the gospel of, hey, you can have it all. You can have individualism and low taxes, and you can have the government services that you've dreamed of. And so we began a kind of living in a mythological bubble.
Hmm.
That, you know, and we stopped taxing the wealthy, and the wealthy moved more and more wealth into their private accounts and offshore and into global investments, and started disinvesting the U.S. infrastructure and private sector production. So we're essentially living with 30, 40 years of incredibly short-sighted, reckless public policy.
And eventually you got to, as they say, pay the piper. And it seems like we're starting to do that. We're talking with author Chuck Collins about his new book, 99 to 1. I'm Bert Cohen. And one of the things that you can actually see as you drive around basically anywhere in the country, and you talk about this in your book, is that we are an obviously divided society. You can see it physically. The rich people are in their areas, sometimes gated communities. The poor and the middle are everywhere else. And what happens then? You get high-quality schools as compared with poorly funded public education. Thus, we share less in common. There's a lack of shared goals. And, you know, you can see that everywhere. How does that kind of divided society affect the notion and the reality of being a republic of the people? How does that affect that? And, boy, I mean, it's amazing how much more you can see that now. You just don't see the middle class as much as there used to be.
Yeah. You know, I mean, this is like one of the most important things. And underlying why inequality matters is this breakdown. It's the breakdown of community. It's the tearing apart of communities. There's a breakdown in solidarity. You know, I grew up in a small Midwestern town where the children of the bankers and the children of the auto mechanics all went to the same high school. So even though there was a division, there was also, there was some common ground. Now, the levels of inequality are so great, the polarization of race and class in America has grown so much in 30 years, that people who are in the 1% really aren't interacting and don't have opportunities to develop empathy toward people in the bottom fifth.
Hmm.
In fact, they become afraid of them. They see them as threats. And people in the bottom fifth don't see people at the top with any empathy either. They see them as distant and greedy and also perpetuate sort of myths about who everyone is. And that's not healthy. And that's one of the reasons why public health is worse and why happiness is lower and overall well-being is lower in extremely unequal societies. So we have to reweave and re-knit the social fabric, and part of that is reducing the gap, the extreme gap, between top and bottom. Nobody's saying we're all going to be equal here.
Right.
There may be, you know, levels of inequality that do reflect individual effort and creativity and input or whatever.
Sure.
Choices. But it's not, it's going to be like 2-1, 3-1, not 10,000-1.
Well, you suggest, and we're, you know, a lot of what's in your book is suggestions for things we can do about this. The idea that no chief executive officer could make more than 100 times the lowest paid worker in that company. What is the situation now?
Oh, well, it's probably closer to 300. Last year, Institute for Policy Studies does a report every year on executive pay, and it was about 364-1, which, you know, it's easy to remember because it's like CEOs make in a day what their average workers make in a year. That's up, by the way, from 42-1 in 1980.
Wow.
The gap between highest and average worker was 42-1 in 1980, and at one point it was over 500-1. Now it's down to 364-1. You know, what that's telling ordinary workers is, hey, you know, we're not in it together here.
Right.
Some people are going to make a lot more money for their effort than you are. And it even good organizational management consultants like Peter Drucker, the kind of the dean of American business management, used to say, you know, when you get over 20-1, you start to poison the atmosphere within a workplace. You start to undermine productivity and morale. And you can see that in American companies where you meet the workers and you realize these folks don't have a stake in this business.
Right.
You can tell. And they feel like, yeah, they're just there to funnel money, funnel their labor to a few rich executives. How hard are you going to work when that's the reality?
Wow. That really does some damage. It really paints the picture. But supposing there were a rule, I mean, to get there, it seems, you know, like a monumental struggle, a rule that no CEO could make more than 100 times the lowest paid worker. I can imagine some Republicans saying, you know, that's Marxist. And the idea of changing the rules for the corporate 1%, just, you know, once we have rules, can you change the rules?
Well, I think that I agree that people in our culture, the idea of an absolute cap on income or a cap on wages just doesn't, it's never going to work.
Right.
I think we're better off arguing, hey, look, let's eliminate the incentives, the tax rules and other incentives that encourage that level of inequality. So I advocate a reform which is, hey, a company can pay their CEO whatever they want, but when that salary exceeds 25 times the lowest paid worker in a company, it's no longer a tax-deductible business expense for the company.
Uh-huh.
Company, if they want to sort of share their profits obscenely to the top, that's their business. But we, the taxpayer, shouldn't have to subsidize that. So there's a couple of interventions like that where, you know, and then I would say, yeah, if somebody's income is over $10 million, it should be taxed as a progressive tax system. So you start to rein in some of the incentives for runaway pay. And the runaway pay issue isn't really, this isn't about sort of pointing the finger at successful, you know, business leaders who are leading companies that are huge global companies, some of which are, I certainly wouldn't want the job, and they're extremely complicated.
Yes.
But what we are worried about is an incentive system that encourages that built-to-loot mentality.
Right.
So if you have CEOs and they're basically paid for 2 or 3 years to restructure companies to extract profit and to funnel value to shareholders with a very short-term horizon, you know, quarter by quarter, month by month, that isn't actually good for the long-term health of that company. That's not good for the long-term shareholders and investors. It's not good for the communities that they operate in. It's certainly not good for the employees. So by reining in excessive CEO pay, we also sort of slow down the off-kilter incentive system that encourages these CEOs to take the money and run today as opposed to make decisions for the long term.
And certainly, you know, when you look at your own budget, it's a question of priorities. It's a question of values. And taxes are the way that society's values apply to everybody. And, excuse me, if we have a tax system now that rewards the game fixers, you know, we can change that. We, the people, have the possibility of changing that. It doesn't have to stay the way it is. For example, very wealthy people oftentimes, as you say, you know, fix the rules and pay a small percentage of their income. I grew up, as I said before, in a time of great prosperity in the 1950s. What were the tax rates then under that evil socialist Dwight Eisenhower?
Well, they were very, very steeply progressive. If, you know, if you had the equivalent in 1955 of income over $2 million today,
yeah,
you would pay on every dollar over that $2 million, you start to pay at a 91% rate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people hear that and they think, wow, they tax 90% of their income. That's not actually true.
Right.
It was just that was the top marginal rate. But the effective rate, meaning the percentage of income in people in the 1% in 1955 paid was about 49%. People paid about 49% of their income in federal taxes. Today, the 1% pays, you know, less than 21% of their income in taxes. And if you the richer you are, the smaller percentage you pay. So you get to a situation where you have a Warren Buffett, and he's only paying 17% of his income, or you have a Mitt Romney,
right,
who earned $21 million last year, he's paying 15% of his income. And that's because income from investments and wealth and dividends is taxed at 15%, and income from work and wages at the higher end is taxed at 35%. So the higher up you go up the economic ladder, the more people's income comes from capital and investments.
Not and productive
the
things.
Tax rates are.
That's crazy. That's yeah. just that it does not serve the economy at all. It does harm to the economy. Well, I want to talk, Chuck Collins, about some of the solutions. We talk about the big banks, and someone has said if they're too big to fail or too big to exist. There are examples like North Dakota, you know, not Cuba, North Dakota, that has a state bank that saves them a heck of a lot of money. What can be done? What would you like to see pushed with regard to the big banks? Should they be broken up? And what about the idea, I like this one, of you call for the creation of a national infrastructure and reconstruction bank. I wonder if you could talk about those aspects of the big banks and our policies.
Yeah, no, there's a whole bunch of reforms in this whole area of what do we do about banks. We have these predator banks, these huge mega banks that took the economy over a cliff. We should be basically breaking those up and dividing them into smaller pieces. We should also stop subsidizing the taxpayers. We should be encouraging the creation of local banks and credit unions that supporting local credit institutions that are more accountable to the credit needs of their communities. And we should do like the North Dakota model, build state banks, use the public treasury and the deposits of the people to invest in banks, hold deposits in banks that are responsible actors. So those are some of the things that we can do to make the credit system and the finance system healthy. You know, too much of the finance system became kind of like a gambling casino.
Mm-hmm.
It became like betting parlors where they took deposits and investments and used them to make these speculative bets in the economy. And that's what brought the economy to the brink. But a lot of what banks and credit institutions do is kind of almost like being a public utility. It is about
Absolutely.
Borrowing and maintaining the secure deposits of depositors and making loans and investments that are in the real economy, creating real goods and businesses and services that are not speculative, but actually you can touch and feel and taste. And that's where, the fact that North Dakota had a state bank means that there was a lot less sort of speculation going on in the banking sector. It sort of maintained a certain accountability.
And amazingly enough, they have a terrific economy there. It's one of the best.
And same with Canada. The reason Canada didn't have the sort of banking crisis that the United States had is that they have a much more highly regulated banking sector.
We can do it here. I wonder how. I mean, there's so many different solutions that there are, and they come from. I love the fact that it's coming from lots of different people. But we talk about taxes as a way of making our priorities and our values into reality. There's been talk about things like a financial transaction tax. Things like that. What kind of new taxes would you suggest? I mean, it's been suggested that you tax the things you really don't want. You tax them the heaviest. Brings up the idea of a carbon tax. But what taxes could there be? Because, I mean, if we talk about, fixing the economy and infrastructure, there's the bank that you just described, obviously, which is a very significant actor in that. But what about, other new taxes that you might think might be useful
yep.
and help the economy?
Well, I think we're in a transition to a new economy that is going to be much more local and green, has to be, really. And we're not going to be, we can't have the same levels of sort of wasteful consumption that we've had in the past. Our current tax system kind of locks us into the old dinosaur economy. It keeps us from, taxes, income, and not consumption and things like that. So there are some really good tax reforms that would sort of help us make the transition to a new economy. And, so what are the bads? There's a notion of taxing the bads.
Right.
Tobacco, tax gasoline, although tax alcohol, because we want to have the real costs of those behaviors be paid by the users. Well, I would argue we should have a carbon tax phased in over 10 years that taxes wasteful carbon dumping. We should have a speculation tax like a Wall Street financial transaction tax. We should tax wasteful or profligate consumption that is extracting, you know, huge amounts of resources from the earth and transferring them into our landfills at an alarming rate. So we tax the new bads, tax pollution, tax speculation. And you mentioned this financial speculation tax or
financial transaction.
People call it a financial transaction tax. This is a great idea. I mean, it's one penny of tax for every $4 of investments, currency, stocks, bonds, derivatives. If you're a ordinary investor, you know, if you buy a share of a mutual fund or you buy stock, most of us are in it for the long term. We're not like rapid turnover traders. But if you're one of these, you know, highfalutin traders who are, you know, flipping investments a couple times a day, a financial transaction tax will be a slightly increased cost of doing business. So it does provide a disincentive for antisocial behavior. But the good news is it raises substantial revenue. It could raise $200-300 billion a year.
Wow.
And the National Nurses Union has totally taken this issue on. The nurses who are on the front end of treating America's patients for all the ways in which the economy appears in our bodies, yeah, have decided that they want to heal America and tax Wall Street. That's their slogan. And they are marching and organizing in support of this financial transaction tax.
Well, makes a lot of sense. I don't think it would slow down anything, really. One penny per $4? Like, oh, come on. I had heard of, I guess that is a quarter of 1%. Right. That's all they're talking about here. I don't know if there's any people in Congress doing that right now. It seems to me part of the problem is that Congress, our government, has worked hand in glove with the game fixers and have, you know, just totally, you know, it's like the game fixers of the 1% say jump, they just say how high. You know, that's been the limitation of what they do. Do you sense that members of Congress are starting to see, hey, they don't just need money, they need actual votes and support? Not yet, huh?
Well, you know, if you think about we're in an impasse, and it's sort of hard to imagine some of these policies actually moving today in this current environment.
Yeah.
We couldn't, you know. What I think is interesting is that a whole bunch of really good ideas are kind of being teed up and debated, even if they're not going to pass. Mm-hmm. And members of Congress are going on record one way or the other.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, April 16th, there was a vote in the Senate on the Buffett rule, at least on whether to allow the issue to go to debate. It was essentially filibustered in our kind of modern filibuster way by the Republicans.
Uh-huh.
But
right.
What was significant is that there was a vote, and it's a powerful symbolic issue, the idea that, hey, if your income is over $1 million, you should pay 30% of your income in income taxes, which is essentially the rate that upper-middle-class people pay. And then the other day there was a vote on student loans and extending student loans, which also was defeated. So I think we're heading into a political season where there's going to be some defining issues, you know, 99-1 defining issues. You know, are you voting against increasing taxes on millionaires, which are, by the way, the public supports them enormously. 70-80%
yes,
of the public thinks we should have a Buffett rule and that millionaires should pay their fair share of taxes.
And I wonder, as the election is upon us now, the election of 2012, I wonder if Obama and the Democrats are so afraid to alienate their big givers. They need so much money. Or do you think that they will listen and speak about, you know, at least talk about it, the 99%. Do you think that they get that it might be a winning stance to stand with the 99%?
I think they do. I mean, President Obama has been making speeches about inequality. They did this whole campaign around the Buffett rule. Usually in presidential election years, the Democratic nominee becomes a populist, meaning starts talking about working class people and, you know, the middle class and inequality. They usually start talking about that around October 13th before the vote,
right,
before the election.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's significant that President Obama, they understand that this is good politics. They understand that if Mitt Romney is as the nominee, he's the quintessential 1% guy.
Oh, my goodness. You couldn't get more of a symbol.
My old high school classmate, Mitt Romney, I can tell you, you know, you earn $21 million a year, and you pay 15% of your income. You have up to $20 million in the Cayman Islands and offshore tax shelters. Bring him on. Let's have a conversation about inequality in America, not off to the side, but at the center of our national politics. So I think it's good policy, but it's in this case, it's going to be good politics. And I was driving through Troy, New York the other day, and somebody's running for Congress, you know, vote for Bert, candidate of the 99%. Thereby defining his opponent as the candidate of the 1%.
Beautiful.
Well, I think we're going to be seeing a lot of that. That's going to be at the center of a lot of campaigns. And if there are defining issues, you know, did Senator Scott Brown vote to protect millionaires by opposing the Buffett rule? Yes.
Yes, he did.
Did Senator Scott Brown vote against expanding student loans for students struggling with massive amounts of debt? Yeah, he voted against that. Okay, here you have it. That's a 99-to-1 political issue. Pick a couple more of those, and you have started to define the key narrative for the political season and beyond.
Well, let's see if they have any backbone at all, if there's any courage. The book is 99-to-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About That. Keep up the energy. Chuck Collins, thank you so much for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show today. Very, very informative.
Thank you, Bert. Take care.
All right, what we need is some new values.
I'm healthy as a horse. But everything is spinning. And if I use a gun, I'm sure to go to prison. I'm stubborn as a mule, and nobody breaks my rules, but nothing comes my way. I got a hard-ass pair of shoulders. I got a love you can't imagine. Yeah, and what I got, I double. Swear I'm keeping out of trouble. I'm looking for one new value. I'm looking for one new value, but nothing comes my way. nothing comes my way.